You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Daniel 8. You ever come into the middle of a conversation and realized, oh, I have no clue what they're talking about? You may feel that way this morning if you're coming here for the first time. Okay, we're in the middle of this book. And it's a book filled with these prophecies, predictions about the future that Daniel lays out. He's this very high-placed administrator in the Babylonian kingdom. And in this book, we see a series of dreams and visions that come to him that basically lay out God's plan for human history. And as we go through each of these visions, they kind of build on each other. Last week, I used the analogy of Google Maps and the layers that you can use in Google Maps. You have like the street view, satellite view, topographical view. And as you add each new layer, you're getting a richer appreciation for that particular geographic location. And the visions that we've been studying in Daniel are layers very much like this. With each new vision, we're getting a richer picture of the flow of human history as Daniel sees it in these visions. And so if you remember, the first vision had to do with a statue. It was in Daniel chapter 2. King Nebuchadnezzar saw this statue. And as we read the interpretation of this vision, it turned out that the four parts of the statue, the head of gold and chest and arms of silver and so on, correspond to four kingdoms, four empires that we know from history. And then when we turn to chapter 7, which was a vision of these four beasts, crazy looking animals that Daniel describes, we learn that these same kingdoms are being represented by these four beasts. And so what's happening is each step of the way, we're getting just a little bit more information. In Daniel 7, the major piece of new information was twofold. One is we got confirmation that there are really two phases to this fourth kingdom. There's ancient Rome. And then there's the 10 kings or 10 nations that are kind of in a loose alliance that come out of ancient Rome that appear toward the very end of history. So that was one piece of information. We kind of got a hint of it in chapter 2, but in chapter 7, it was really clear. There's this ancient Rome part that follows Greece, but then later, right before God established his kingdom, there's this 10-nation phase. And then a second bit of information we got out of Daniel 7 had to do with this character called the Little Horn, who appears during this final phase of history, who comes up among these 10 nations. And I made the case last week that the Little Horn is a very powerful, global, wicked ruler who will control what people buy and sell and dominate world affairs at the end of history. A person that has many names in the Bible, most famously known as the Antichrist. Okay, so that's kind of getting you, that's my best shot at bringing you into the conversation that we're having. Now, Daniel 8. In Daniel 8, which is this is such a fascinating chapter, we get introduced to someone called the small horn, which is kind of unfortunate because it's so similar sounding to the little horn. But notice, and I put him up here in this way, he does not appear at the very end of history like the little horn. He emerges during the Greek era, during the tail end of the kingdom of Greece. And so even though their names are similar, they're different. You've got the little horn in chapter 7, the small horn in chapter 8. And I know it's confusing. It is. But the little horn, even though they have similar nicknames, even though they're similar to each other, they do appear at different times, and they are different people. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. These two symbols in these two chapters are referring to two similar but very different rulers. The little horn, like I've said, is the Antichrist. But who is this small horn guy connected to the Greek kingdom? Well, that's what we're going to try to find out this morning. So let's do that. Diving into chapter 8, verse 1, it says, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. Okay, so Belshazzar was a king of Babylon. He's the last king of Babylon, actually. And because it mentions the third year of Belshazzar, we can precisely date the year in which Daniel received this vision. It was 550 BC. Okay, this is very clearly, we know there was a Belshazzar, and the third year of his reign was 550 BC. All right, now just to help you appreciate what was happening in Daniel's life and with the people of Israel at this time. Well, prior to this, in 605 BC, the Babylonians began taking people, taking Jews from Jerusalem and bringing them back to Babylon, where they stayed in exile for 70 years. The other thing that was happening, that had happened by this time, is that Jerusalem had been conquered and there was no temple. Okay, there was no temple. It had been completely destroyed. It wouldn't be rebuilt again until 516 BC. So these are some of the grim realities that the Jews in exile in Babylon were dealing with in the year 550 BC when Daniel received this vision. Okay, and so here we go. Daniel says, I looked in the vision. And while I was looking, I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam. And I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. Now, this is really strange. Susa in 550 BC was not a very big place. It was in the far edge, the far eastern edge of the Babylonian Empire. But pretty soon after this, a few decades later, Susa would become the capital of the Medo-Persian Empire, the next empire that's going to come in after Babylon. And so this vision really focuses on that pivot, moving away from the Babylonian era and toward the coming of the Medo-Persian Empire. Daniel says, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now, the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. All right, very weird, kind of a lopsided ram with one horn longer than the other. You know, and I realize this sounds really weird. This is just like almost, if you've read Nostradamus, Nostradamus is like this. It's completely unintelligible. What makes these predictions so unique and so different is, in addition to this crazy vision, we get a crystal clear explanation. It says in Daniel 8, verse 20, the ram that you saw with the two horns, we don't have to guess, it represents the kings of Media and Persia. Oh, thank you. That's so helpful. I don't have to like try to figure this out. Yes, that's what we're looking at. This kingdom of Medo-Persia, which followed Babylon, where you have one horn larger than the other, which is fitting because the Persian part of this empire was dominant over the Median part. It represents the kings of Media and Persia. And so if we go over to our chart, right, where we're kind of keeping track of how these visions layer on top of each other, we see with Medo-Persia, and just let this wash over you. Think about this. Think about the imagery. Medo-Persia symbolized as a chest joining two arms of silver. as a bear that Daniel tells us has one side that's raised up from the other. And then we hear about, in Daniel 8, we hear about a ram that has two horns, one larger than the other. Do you see the parallelism, right? Do you see it? This is deliberate. This is incredible. This is crystal clear evidence that the second kingdom is Medo-Persia. There's nothing like this anywhere outside the Bible. There's nothing like what you're looking at here. While I was observing, so still kind of looking at that ram, it says, while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. He came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered its two horns. And the ram had no strength to withstand him, so he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. And then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Again, weird. Flying goat. Now, I had to put this up. Many of you knew my wife. When my wife was little, her family had a pet goat, which is a bad idea, okay? I don't recommend this, but she would tell stories about how this goat would chase them all over the place. They were terrified by this goat, so. This one's way worse. This is a super fast flying goat with a giant horn. What a crazy image. This is the kind of thing, maybe I've never dropped acid. Maybe this is the kind of thing, you know, maybe this is what I would see if I did. I'm not going to try, don't worry. So what is up with this goat? It's a fast-moving goat because it comes from the west and covers the whole surface of the earth without touching the ground. It also has this weird horn that at some point gets broken and it's replaced by four horns. Like, what? Well, once again, this is what's so great about this. The angel Gabriel, who is with Daniel, keeps providing these interpretations so that we don't get lost. Check this out. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. We don't have to wonder. And the large horn that's between his eyes is the first king. Okay, so the goat is Greece, and the big horn is this really powerful, fast-moving king, I guess, who started this kingdom into motion. The kingdom of Greece. And the large horn is the king. I think that's very helpful. And as we look in history, scholars of every stripe agree we're talking about Alexander the Great. Okay, this is anybody, you take a class at OSU, wherever you go, everyone reading this passage will say this is about Alexander the Great. Alexander's the one whose army conquered the Medo-Persians. He just finally put them to bed for good. He also expanded his empire very quickly. We know, for example, that he basically went from Macedonia and Greece all the way to India, conquering territory in about 10 years, which is like an ancient blitzkrieg, right? Super fast moving, like a flying goat. He also died suddenly at the height of his power. He was partying. Some people say he had a fever. Some people say he had alcohol poisoning. Others speculate that he was maybe assassinated. But everyone agrees, at the very height of Alexander's power, he suddenly died. And if you remember, that's just what we read in Daniel 8, verse 8. As soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. Okay, so again, this perfectly fits. The kicker for me and for everybody that studies this is this. the broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms, which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. And it's just simply a fact of history that after a little bit of instability, at the end of Alexander's empire, when he exited the world stage, eventually his kingdom was divided into four kingdoms, just like this vision describes. Okay, everything, we could get even into even more detail. Every single thing about what we've just read points to somebody who really existed, Alexander the Great. So yeah, we've got the Medo-Persian lopsided two-horned ram, and we've got this crazy flying goat that symbolizes Greece. Now, just to kind of keep the plate spinning. So the male goat magnifies himself exceedingly, but as soon as he's mighty, this is Alexander the Great, the large horn is broken, and in its place comes up four conspicuous horns. These are these four Greek, lesser Greek kingdoms that come out of the Greek Empire toward the four winds of heaven. And then out of one of them, okay, out of one of the four horns, out of one of those lesser Greek kingdoms that follows Alexander the Great's kingdom, he says, a rather small horn grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. Aha, the small horn. Here we are. And I just want to point out, where are we in history? We're not at the very end of history. This small horn is coming out of the Greek era, out of one of those four kingdoms that followed the single great kingdom of Alexander the Great. And he, just like we saw in chapter 7, Daniel spills a lot of ink on who this small horn is and how he operates. The small horn grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. And it even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. It removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary, of God's sanctuary, was thrown down. He's talking about the temple here. He says, on account of the transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with a regular sacrifice, and this horn will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply? While this transgression that causes horror is going on, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled. So something bad happens, right? Really bad that this small horn perpetrates. And it says, he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be restored. Okay, there's so much in here. Here's the headline. This small horn, whoever he is, he's a king, that's all we know. Right, he does something really bad at the temple, something that they called a transgression that causes horror. Okay, so really bad thing that he did at the temple. Now we flip over to the angel Gabriel, who's going to give us a little more understanding about this small horn guy. Gabriel tells Daniel, in the latter part of their rule. Okay, who's he talking about? He's talking about those four horns. The four kingdoms that came from Alexander the Great's kingdom. These are four lesser Greek kingdoms. In the latter part of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. So, I mean, you could already guess. Horns all through this part of Daniel point to kings or kingdoms. And here we're flat out told, this small horn guy, he is a king who emerges from the latter part of the Greek era, not the Antichrist, but somebody who's showing up already in the past during this latter part of the Greek kingdom. Gabriel continues, his power will be mighty, but not by his own power. and he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. Okay. Let's see if we can... Oh, yeah, and through his shrewdness, I forgot about this. He will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. He'll magnify himself in his heart. He'll destroy many while they're at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. Okay, again, lots in there. Here's the thing I want to try to draw your attention to is everything that we've read about the small horn in chapter 8 is very similar to what we learned about the Antichrist in chapter 7. They're very similar rulers. Like the Antichrist, this small horn is boastful. It says that he magnified himself to be equal with the commander of the host, that's God. It also says he'll magnify himself in his heart. So this is something we saw with the Antichrist. So this small horn king, very, very boastful. He's also hostile to God's people. It says he's going to destroy mighty men and the holy people. And he's hostile to God. And we see his hostility to God preeminently in the terrible things he does in the temple. Okay, all through here, the emphasis as we're reading about the small horn is this horrible thing he does in the temple. It says that he removed the regular sacrifice, that he throws down the sanctuary, and that these actions are viewed as a transgression causing horror. And just in case we're not clear about this, this is a great thing about Daniel. I'll jump ahead to a couple visions, but this comes up again, the small horn and what he does in the temple. And here's what we learn. It says, forces from him, from this small horn, are going to arise and desecrate the sanctuary fortress and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they'll set up the abomination of desolation. Now, you're probably like, oh, I've heard that before. I know that phrase, abomination of desolation. Maybe even out in the popular culture, people have heard about this before. And who do you associate that with? The Antichrist, right? This final evil ruler of the world who hates God and hates God's people is going to go into the temple, according to the Bible, at the end of history, into the Jewish temple in Jerusalem and proclaim himself to be God. And it's called this action, it's called an abomination because God hates it. And it's called a desolation because it renders the temple unclean and useless. And so, yes, that's true. The Antichrist does commit an abomination of desolation. But in this passage, we're not talking about somebody at the end of history. We're talking about somebody who's already come and gone, a ruler from the Greek era who also does something terrible in the temple that Daniel calls an abomination of desolation. Ooh. So, wow, it's like they are both doing this very specific thing. And so it's true. Again, the headline, the thing to focus on, is the small horn king in Daniel 8 is very similar to the Antichrist, but he appears at a different period in history. And just, maybe this is redundant, but see that? Antichrist at the bottom of the page there? Appearing right at the end of history during that 10-nation confederacy, but here the small horn, he's emerging out of Greece. They really are different people who do very similar things. And so if that's true, imagine you're like a recruiter looking to hire someone, okay? If we want to figure out who this small horn king is, he's got to fit a certain resume, okay? He's got to be a Greek-era king who was arrogant, who hates God and his people, and who actually goes into the Jewish temple or is involved in doing something with the Jewish temple that is an abomination of desolation. And you know what? When we go back through the pages of history, there is somebody that we could hire for the job that perfectly matches this resume, and that guy is Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth. And that bust, by the way, scholars say is a pretty close representation of what he actually looked like. It was one of those ones that was, you mold someone's face to try to come close to help the sculptor. He's kind of creepy looking, I think, just looking at him. This guy, was he a king from the Greek era? Yes. He ruled one of the four kingdoms that followed Alexander's empire. He was a Seleucid ruler. That was one of the four kingdoms. He was incredibly arrogant. Now, these two books, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, they're not in our Bibles, but they do contain useful sources of historical information. And if you read them in multiple places, they talk about Antiochus the Fourth, and they talk about just how incredibly arrogant he is. If you go to this part of the world, they've dug up coins that Antiochus the Fourth struck. That's him on the left. And he called himself Epiphanes. That's the Greek rendering of Epiphanes right there. Guess what it means? God manifest. Okay, so Antiochus believed he was the human embodiment of Zeus. Okay, so this guy had a huge ego, truly arrogant. He also was horribly cruel to the Jewish people. I went back and forth a lot as I thought about how much to get into on this, because it's not easy. To hear. But I decided you need to hear some of this because it's important to the point we'll be making later. Antiochus was a monster. He did horrible things to the people of Jerusalem. He outlawed, like, reading the Bible, reading the Torah. He banished people from observing Jewish festivals. He made it illegal for parents to circumcise their children. And one time, Antiochus's people found out that a couple women had defied their authority and gone ahead and had their kids circumcised. And so they found those women, killed their children, killed their babies, made the women hang their babies around their neck and walk through the streets of Jerusalem as they were mocked by people in the city. And then when that was all over, they took these women to the highest part of the wall of the city around Jerusalem and hurled them down to their death, okay? There's another episode where there was a pretty large group of Jewish folks that were observing a day of Sabbath rest in a cave, and they were betrayed by somebody, and Antiochus's people rounded them up and burned them all alive. And I could just go on and on. This guy was terrible. It brings you to tears just thinking about having to live through the reign of a monster like this. And so, but that's important for us to have this concrete historic example of how terrible Antiochus the Fourth was is important. The other thing is he set up an image of Zeus in the temple and slaughtered a pig on the altar. That is recorded all over the place. This is the abomination of desolation that we're reading about in chapter 8 and also in chapter 11. This was so offensive to the Jews, they rose up in a successful revolt, threw out the Greek rulers, became independent, I think by 163 BC. This is the victory that the Jews celebrate in December when they observe Hanukkah. So, yeah. Anyhow, so that's who it was. The little horn is the Antichrist. The small horn in chapter 8 is this monster, Antiochus the Fourth. Now, let's go back to Daniel's setting. It's 550 BC. The Jews have been in exile. Jerusalem's conquered. It would be another couple hundred years before Alexander the Great would appear on the scene and do everything that Daniel describes. And then it would be another 160-ish years or so until Antiochus the Fourth appeared and did all the stuff that we just read about. So what I'm saying is, even though Daniel was in the 6th century BC, he saw all of this unfolding through this vision. And these events that he describes weren't partially fulfilled. They were all fulfilled, 100% fulfilled, which makes you go, how did he do that? You know, how could he have the ability to see into the future? That's supernatural. Well, some people would say, critics of the Bible would say he didn't do that, that this whole book is a forgery, that it was written not in 550 BC, but in 164 BC, after the events that it supposedly predicts. It purports to be prophecy, but it's really just this clever deception. And I would just say to that, why are they picking that specific date? It's because it's the first year after all of these events happened. It's because they're uncomfortable with the idea that if this book was really written in the 6th century BC, it is undeniably supernatural. I think everyone would agree, if the date is correct, if Daniel actually wrote this in 550 BC, this is supernatural prophecy. And so that's the million-dollar question. Was it really written? Daniel received this vision in 550. The book was completed by 536, according to my perspective and the perspective of a lot of folks. And the evidence for that 536 BC date is very strong, and I don't have time to get into it. I will say a couple things. One is, at the end of this teaching, after I'm done and you're just milling around, I'm going to have them put up a rotating slide with evidence for the 536 BC date. And then it'll have my email there, and you can email me, and I'll send you a paper to give you more information about. But the case for the earlier date is very strong. It's super strong. And let's say, even if we're wrong about that, which we're not, even if you quibble about the date, there is a prediction that we're going to cover in 2 weeks that accurately describes something that came true in 33 AD. It's undeniably fulfilled. And you can move the date all you want, and there's no way to get around the fact there is supernatural prophecy in this book. Okay. The Antichrist is yet to come. The small horn Antiochus has already appeared. That's the big picture. Both are similar, but they are different. Now, there is one problem in this passage that drives a lot of people nuts. After this vision about Antiochus the Fourth, the small horn, check out what Gabriel says. Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. Okay, now that's a curveball. When he says the end, he's not talking about the near future. He's talking about the far future. He's talking about the end of history. He is saying what we've read about Antiochus the Fourth, who has already come and gone, somehow pertains to the far future. Why? How could he say that? How can past events in Antiochus's life somehow point to the distant future? And here's my answer. Antiochus the Fourth foreshadows the Antichrist. Antiochus the Fourth acts in ways that typify what the Antichrist will do. And I think this is important because when you think, oh, this future leader's going to come and he's going to persecute people and it's going to be really terrible, that's what the Antichrist will be like. It can feel very remote and distant and hard to get your brain around. And I think by comparing him to Antiochus the Fourth, if you're wondering, well, what is the Antichrist going to really be like? You're supposed to go back and look at the horrific historic example of Antiochus the Fourth. If you think Antiochus the Fourth was wicked, just wait until the Antichrist comes. It's going to be terrible. It will be especially terrible if you're trying to follow God. That's the point of this, I think. He's taking this historical figure and he's pointing him forward to try to foreshadow what this Antichrist will eventually be like. And I say that because when Jesus talks about the book of Daniel, listen to what he says. He's talking about this future event when the Antichrist goes into the temple. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, and then he says this weird parenthetical comment, let the reader understand. Now, why would he do that? I think Jesus is doing this because he knows that there is more than one abomination of desolation in Daniel. He's not talking about the one Antiochus did. He's talking about the one that is yet to come. And listen to what he says. When you see someone roll into the temple in the future and like proclaim themselves to be God the way the Bible predicts, he says, pay attention because then there will be a great tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will, unless those days had been cut short. This is how bad it would be. No life would have been saved. Okay, and so a lot of people are like, well, how can we ever know that we're getting close to the end? And there's all this speculation, people looking into all these different trends. This is what Jesus says we should look for. If at some point in the future, we see a leader emerge who, like Antiochus IV, goes into the Jewish temple and does this, we should pay attention. There isn't even a Jewish temple yet, but if it's rebuilt and somebody goes in and does this, that's a key harbinger right there that we're close to the end. That means all hell is about to break loose when this happens. I mean, how bad? Worse than Antiochus IV, bad, really bad. Jesus says it'll be like a great tribulation. That's his term for it. It'll be characterized by several things, and we'll get into this more when we get to Daniel 11. All-out warfare, persecution of believers, and great spiritual deception. People coming forth, doing miracles, and trying to persuade people they're the true Messiah and leading people away from the true God. It'll be a dizzying, difficult, painful chapter in human history like no other. Now, I mentioned this in the Q&A last week. Christians, if you know the Lord right now, you'll likely miss all this because I believe just from looking at these passages across the whole Bible, the evidence suggests that we'll be removed, we'll be what's called raptured, taken up to God before the you-know-what hits the fan, okay? So we'll be kind of taken out. And taken to be with God. But those who remain, many people who remain will be living through this great tribulation. They'll be turning to Jesus and they're going to face incredibly difficult times. And we go back to Antiochus to try to appreciate just how bad those times will be. So what to do about this? So much that we could say, but I'll say this. One thing is, when the Bible talks about the Great Tribulation, it actually offers advice to people who are alive at that time. You can read about this in Revelation 12. The author John the Apostle talking about how to get through this horrible period if you're following God. Listen to what he says. He says, they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony, and they didn't love their life even when faced with death. Okay, so these are people trying to follow God in this horrible time, and I think these points he gives us are applicable for anybody, all of us at some point are going to face adversity because we're trying to follow God. We're going to get pushback from people because we're trying to follow God, right? And so these three points he makes, I think anybody could benefit from this. One is the blood of the Lamb. And what is he talking about there? The Lamb is Jesus. He's called a Lamb because he willingly offered his own life as a sacrifice, like a sacrificial lamb in the temple. He offered himself on the cross and he bled to death and died. The blood of the Lamb. so that we could be forgiven. He actually took on all the wrath from God that we deserve. He bore that on his shoulders. He took all our guilt onto himself. And because he did that, we can just go to him and ask him for forgiveness we could never earn. We can tell him, I can't do what needs to be done. You've already done it, Jesus. Thank you for dying for me. I want that to apply to my life. I want to receive the forgiveness you offer as a gift. I don't know if you've ever done that, but that is the most important thing you could ever do if you were alive during this time or just period. If you want to know how to put your feet on something solid and unshakable so that you'll be with God forever, this is how you do it. You turn to Jesus and rely on what he did for you, not what you do for yourself. Trust him to forgive you. You know, the other thing about, I think I'm speculating here, but if you're following God in adversity and you're getting a lot of criticism and you're seeing people get taken out by persecution, I think that that period of time, you're going to be really struggling with a lot of guilt. You're going to be like, did I make the right decision? Am I standing as firm as I should be? There's going to be a lot of, you know, that sense of the inner work, like, am I really doing what I need to do? And that also is one we need to go to the blood of the Lamb. And I say this because Satan will be very active. He is active. God's enemy is always looking to drive a wedge between God's people and God. And one of the biggest ways he does it is through accusation, through piling on. You know, when we blow it, which we often do, you know, he cruises in and he's like, that's the last straw. You call yourself a Christian? That's pathetic. Why would God want to do anything, have anything to do with you? We labor under accusation even now. Some of us maybe, I don't know what happened this weekend, but some of us are, right as we sit here, are feeling a weight of accusation. And the solution to that isn't to minimize what you've done. And it's not to go blame somebody for what you've done. It's just to, in humility, come to God and receive his love. Listen to this. He says, brethren, since we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Christ, let's draw near with a sincere heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. So yeah, not denials, not minimizations, but just a humble, sincere heart where we're just owning what's happened and then resting in the love and trust relationship that we have. Because Jesus, our Lamb, died for us. So crucial. Such a great bit of advice here if you're going serving God through a time of persecution. Here's another one. The word of their testimony. Okay, what is the word of their testimony? The word is just what God's revealed in the Bible. The word is what we've been studying, all these visions. The word has demonstrated, and you'll see as we keep going, it's demonstrated this God's message of hope, his salvation, his wisdom. It can be trusted. That clinging to that is going to be crucial during this period because it's going to be so filled with spiritual deception. The one solid thing we're going to be able to cling to is what this book says. And then, of course, it's not just something that we need to cling to. It's a message other people need to hear. That's why he calls it a word of their testimony. The idea that we would not just sit on what we've learned here, but take it out to people in the world who need to hear it, out of love, not out of arrogance. And just knowing, too, in a time like this, if we cling to the word and we take it out to people, we're going to pay a price for that. Which is why he says part of his advice is not loving your life even when faced with death. I was talking to Kevin Furno after this teaching last week, and he brought up a great analogy. He was like, you know, when you and I, when we watch a football game, a live OSU football game, a big game, you know how flipped out you can get, how you can yell and scream. And I'm like, that's totally true. My wife used to ask me to leave the room I was so bad during like big games. But have you ever rewatched like one of the Buckeyes national championship games that they've already won? You ever done that? What's that like? It's not as stressful. You're just like, okay, yeah, I remember that. I remember that interception, but it's okay. We're gonna win. It's fine. Yeah, it's so much easier to watch. And I think there's something about that. Jesus wins. And if we can hold on to that basic idea, yeah, it's crazy. Maybe somebody here at one point might face martyrdom, losing their life for sharing their faith. But when you know your eternity is secure with the Lamb who shed his blood for you, it puts it in perspective. And that's another thing that we need to hold on to. So, Father, just thanks for these questions. There's so many things we could talk about. I pray for these three main points here, just that we cling to what you did for us, Jesus. Thanks that we can just go to you and be received as we are. Thanks to that we have this word to share and to hold on to and to learn about. And give us the courage to face whatever adversity that might be coming with the calmness that comes from knowing you win. Help us with those things, God. Amen.